Hi, it's the show on KJZZ. I'm Steve Goldstein.
And I'm Mark Brody, and this is our podcast version of the program. The show is one of our original productions. It's a curated program of news and features from Phoenix and the state, along with national and international stories.
You can also find segments and additional information at theshow.kjzz.org.
Thanks for listening to the podcast.
Good morning. Thanks for listening to the show here on KJZZ 91.5 in Phoenix with Mark Brody. I'm Steve Goldstein. Now it's time for the Friday newscap and some voices from the news this week.
We're a big tent party, and that's what this is all about. It's democracy in action. It's how the sausage is made. So we welcome every voice in our party. They have a right to share their opinion, and ultimately that's what makes our party stronger is the diversity of thought and diversity of voice.
This will be my last academic year serving as president of the University of California. I intend to serve until August 1st of 2020.
Everyone should be free to peacefully live and work according to their beliefs, without fear of unjust punishment.
This case was never about one business refusing to acknowledge the humanity of our LGBTQ community. It was about whether we will accept discrimination in our community. The ordinance is not just something nice to have on paper. It's something we have seen been used to lodge complaints by community members who feel they have been unfairly targeted.
With us to talk about many things, including the Brush and Nib Arizona Supreme Court case, the eight people who are under consideration to be Maricopa County Attorney, are Julie Earfley, communications consultant at Earfley Uncuffed, and former state lawmaker Stan Barnes of Copper State Consulting. Guys, welcome back.
Great to be here.
Julie, let's start. We have eight finalists now for Maricopa County Attorney. Kind of an interesting list. Anybody stand out to you?
Well, a couple of women definitely stand out. Alistair Adele, I know in the law enforcement community, is very well respected, very well liked. And then there's Rachel Mitchell, who obviously stands out because of her role in the Kavanaugh hearing. And I think it's kind of that dichotomy, actually, between women. I think you have a situation where if the board was thinking long term, and I'm sure their first consideration is who is going to win in 2020, that's more than qualifications. That's number one on their list of who they're going to pick. And I think if they really look at what's going on in the Republican Party, they may realize that there is a bit of an issue with women, at least with women of color, unmarried women, young women, highly educated women. So they may want to appoint somebody who is female. If they appoint someone like an Alistair Adele, they have, I think, an advantage. If they appoint someone like Rachel Mitchell, I think it actually brings down the female vote because of her role in the Kavanaugh hearing.
Stan, how significant is this call, considering this person is going to serve for 1 year, certainly, and then we'll see from there?
Yeah, I think it's significant because of the leg up it gives them in the election. It depending on how it breaks out, it actually could just make that person the heir apparent through the election, right? So that's why everyone is playing so difficult or so hard for this. It won't surprise anyone that's listening that I don't agree with what Julie said in terms of her perspective about
it. It's not a big tent. Is it a big tent?
I'm sorry. I'm cringing over here. I love Julie, but what comes out of her mouth sometimes? I hope the Board of Supervisors does not put this appointment through a politically correct filter. I think it would be wrong on a lot of levels. But I do say that there are some really qualified women that are running for that job, including the two that were mentioned that have careers there that know what they're talking about. I think it's really interesting. There's a couple of just politicians that are in there, including my old Senate colleague John Cadis, who wants to come back and be an elected official again. That's interesting to me.
I don't want to scare you, but when I saw John Cadis' name, for some reason Stan Barnes popped into my head.
Is that right?
Wait a second. Here's a guy who was on TV, then went into the legislature, and then became, you know, someone who did pretty successful in other aspects of life.
I can't decide if this is a compliment or not, but I'll take it as one.
It's anyway. A fact, right?
And then isn't Glassman in this list too, Rodney Glassman?
Rodney Glassman, yeah.
I think Rodney, I have a very low opinion of Rodney, and I think he's probably just proven to everybody he's just looking for an opportunity. I think he's probably low on the ladder of getting appointed to this thing, but he wants to be there evidently. So it's kind of a fun political science experiment for the five supervisors.
Right.
And it ends up being a really important job. Really important job. And all our Democratic friends seem to be kind of left out of the whole thing.
Yeah. Well, I would agree with your view on Rodney Glassman. I would think that he is definitely unpopular, I think, in both parties, to be totally honest. I disagree that this won't be a political appointee, though, mainly because we wouldn't have this opening if it wasn't political. I mean, I think if you look at the fact that Bill Montgomery was appointed to the Arizona Supreme Court, he was definitely the least qualified of all of the candidates. So this opening in general is political.
Yeah, I think the politically correct filter is what I'm thinking of. Right. I know it's political. I mean, this is – everything's political. But I'm hoping that we don't give points for being female or points for being of color. I just think that's the wrong way to go about making this appointment. I want a qualified person who can win the office and do fair and right by everybody.
Well, Stan, do you agree with Julie's assessment that the ability to win next year would be front and center for the supervisors in making this decision?
I think it's not more important than other parts of the equation. It is a factor. It is something. But I still believe Maricopa County is a Republican county in spite of some of the very interesting things like Sinema winning the county and Paul Pinzon being the sheriff. I think those are in their own silo of specialty. And in general, the county attorney of Maricopa County is going to be a Republican. And so winning that job from the Republican point of view is more of a layup, I think, as long as you're competent.
What are the other factors you think they should be considering?
I think experience matters. I think proven temperament matters. I think that if you can demonstrate that you understand the role, and I think that matters. This is why I think my political friends are on the weak side of it. But they have that special sauce. That is, they have relationships with the five supervisors who make the appointment. And to Julie's point, that's where it does become political because Cadis has been around a long time. He's traded favors with these guys. He contributes to campaigns and all that. So he's a noted and human beings are human beings, and they want to appoint their friends to jobs if they're qualified. So that's going to be part of it.
Julie, how will the Democrats who ultimately run for this race, how much does it matter who the person is that is appointed by the Board of Supervisors in terms of a Democrat trying to win this next year?
I think it matters quite a bit. I think if you have someone who hasn't had particularly criminal experience, because there are several appointments who seem to have more corporate law experience than criminal, I think that that's a place where some Democratic candidates could come in and tout that they have better experience, that they're better suited for this office. I think also if you have someone like a Rachel Mitchell who is already tainted by controversy, you also have an opening for Democrats to be able to say, listen, we already have had a lot of controversy in this office with Bill Montgomery, with Andrew Thomas. We need to bring integrity back to this office. And so I think they could make it a point depending on who the eventual appointee is.
I don't agree, Julie, that Rachel is carrying a taint of controversy. I think she got a certain elevated superstar status in that whole
thing. Doesn't she make it, though, where people are so passionate? I'm sorry, Julie, I'll let you finish. But it's because the Kavanaugh hearings got so intense.
Oh, goodness.
Whatever, it creates a side there that maybe – I mean, Bill Montgomery did too, but it's not like a Romney where he's political but doesn't necessarily get people so excited on both sides.
It gets people really paying attention to this race, and it creates a very, I think, partisan edge to the race because while Stan may not see how this really affected women, women were deeply offended by a lot of the line of questioning that Rachel Mitchell used during the Kavanaugh hearing. It seemed like she was not really trying to get to the facts so much as she was trying to provide as much doubt as possible. And so I think when you're talking not just Democratic women, but independents and some Republicans as well, they were offended by that. And so she does carry, I think, a taint going into this office, if she goes into this office.
Well, so what about what Stan said that he still thinks Maricopa County is Republican at this point? Do you agree with that?
Maricopa County is still Republican, but I think it is becoming more purple. And we are definitely seeing a path forward for Democrats, particularly among more educated suburban Republican women. And so, again, I think that's where this topic plays, right, is that if you have somebody who is more polarizing among women, it's going to be harder to – it's going to be easier, actually, for the Democrat to have a place in this race.
Stan, do you think the Board of Supervisors ultimately goes with the decision from that citizens' board, or do you think they do? They have sort of a decision in mind, and if it lines up with that board, great. If not, they're going to do their own
thing. I think you're making a very good point. I think they're going to hide behind That sounds more negative than I mean it. But I think it's a very convenient thing for a political guy who's got multiple friends and it's a very complicated decision to say the citizens panel went through this process and recommended this. Therefore, I am with that. That's a very convenient political tool for the elected supervisors. It rids them of some of the responsibility, weirdly, in a good way for them.
Well, one thing that struck me is we keep hearing Bill Gates as a possibility for county attorney, and Bill Gates is one of the supervisors. Would he try to pick someone he could beat in a primary?
I think someone's overthinking it, really. If I were supervising Gates, I wouldn't want to lower myself to actually working as the county attorney. I mean, those guys have to work and make hard decisions. Supervisors just vote on a budget and go to lunch. So I don't know why he'd really want the job. But.
Do you think at this point there is a favorite?
No, I don't. But I would admit to your listeners, I'm not an insider in that, but I don't think there's a favorite. I think there's the overt political dynamic, the relationship thing like Cadis has, and then there are some really credible people that are tenured professionals. And my own instinct is they're going to do better with the citizens panel than the more political thing. And so my own wager personally is that it's going to be somebody that is not been in elected office before that gets that position.
Julie, let's move on to state legislative news. I guess I can use the term moderate Republican. Is that okay to use, Stan? Is that a real thing? State Senator Heather Carter, who would be considered one of those moderates, is going to be challenged by Nancy Bartow, who has been in the legislature for quite a while and has more of a certainly socially conservative bent. What do you make of the fact that there's going to be this sort of battle? This is one of those that gets the railbirds sort of excited to see, mm-hmm. Wow, two well-known names. How do you see this challenge?
Well, I think it'll be interesting. I think, you know, perhaps Nancy Bartow has realized that on the Republican side, more of the activist group has now really become the base. It really is this party of Trump. And so she may see that and see her chance to take someone like Heather Carter, who is just much more thoughtful, and she is more moderate down at the state legislature. And so it's possible Bartow could win, although I get the sense that Heather Carter is really well-loved in her district as well. So I think it'll be a fascinating race to watch. I think it'll be an incredibly expensive race, and I think it'll say a lot about where the primary voters are, the Republican base. Are they willing to continue to accept somebody like Heather Carter who can get things done but is more moderate? Or have they really just become that party of Trump and they have to have someone like a Nancy Bartow?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and Julie, I think you're right on with that analysis.
You.
Congratulations. I think Nancy has decided, probably has 50 people around her that say, you need to go back and reclaim that for the real Republican part of the party. And those people tend to be the folks that turn out to precinct meetings and that sort of thing. Mm-hmm. So I'm sure Representative Bartow has heard a lot about it. And she was in the Senate. So, I mean, she kind of feels like she's got her name on that already, right? And Senator Carter leveraged the whole legislature at the end of the last session over a budget item and a non-budget item. And that ended up irritating leadership, the Republican leadership center. So Nancy Bartow might actually have some, you know, little cheering squad within the legislature itself, which is kind of weird insider dynamics. But Heather Carter is one dynamic individual and one fundraising machine as well. And she's going to outwork Representative Bartow. She's going to out-hustle her. I don't, to the extent that means anything, I don't know. But she's going to out-raise her and out-hustle her. But I do think it's going to be a bit of a test about where that primary voter is, and I don't know the answer on that. I do know that it's happening in other districts, like it's happening in the Tempe district between Democrats, and that's that same thing is playing itself out. Even Democrats in the legislature, who I consider to be center left people, are getting primaries from the left,
right.
And so this is a really interesting flower that's blooming right here in the Arizona legislature to see the politics happening.
Do you tend to see this more in districts that are safe for one party or the other? I mean, Carter and Bartow's district, that's not really a competitive district. The Tempe district, kind of, probably more competitive than that North Phoenix district, but not super competitive. Are you tending to find these in more safe districts where the incumbent is being challenged either from the left or right, depending on their party?
Yeah, the circumstances where within the district, one elected official that's an incumbent is running against another that's an incumbent. That's only happening in these lopsided districts. And Tempe has really become just a solid blue district. But the this phenomenon of solid districts that are Democratic getting further left primary kind of thing, that used to be a Republican problem. That's how yours truly came to the legislature 30 years ago, right?
Thank the Lord for that.
I thank you. I'm glad you said that. I mean, so I ran at 30 years ago as a 27-year-old kid to the right of the incumbents and won. And the Republicans have been suffering that for three decades.
It's all my fault.
I was on the front edge of it, first thing ever. But the now it's happening to our Democratic friends, which I think is a very interesting phenomenon.
Well,
I was going to ask, do you think that Democrats might take another look? I mean, there's going to be an open House seat in that district. Is this one that you think Democrats could realistically take a look at and say, maybe if we try the single shot, maybe if we have one really strong candidate, we could sneak somebody in there?
I think they're trying that in a number of districts, and it's definitely worth a shot. I think the single-shot candidate is definitely the way to go. That district is still leans pretty heavy Republican, though, so I think that it's unlikely, but definitely I know you always want to have somebody running. I mean, you really do. You got to give voters a choice. And over time, when you run somebody who is a little bit more moderate and can have some cross appeal, you just continue to hopefully change the dynamics in that district.
I think Mark's on point here as well. That what happened in that Central Phoenix district, where there were some real battles in primaries and then the Democrats picked up a House seat, that phenomenon actually could play itself out there, even though it's a longer shot because of the dynamics. But Nancy Bardot is violating an unwritten rule. You're not supposed to run against someone in your own party in the other chamber. You're supposed to work that out. And so that is going to lead to an electorate that's sophisticated enough in part to be mad enough to vote for the other person. And so it's going to be a real—
You think it hurts Bardot?
What I really mean to say is that there will be a constituency that's so mad that when they get to that their candidate lost the primary and now they're in the general, that their vote is going to go in a weird dynamic, rather out of their heart, but in some sort of strategy out of their head. There won't be everybody, but it'll be somebody.
But Sam, before we go to break, so Paul Boyer and Heather Carter were both criticized on an open mic, as a matter of fact, when things were going through this. So ultimately, does that affect how things get done? Does that affect, do you think it's possible Nancy Bardot, not just 50 people, but maybe people actually in the legislature said, come on, we need you to get in there.
I touched on that a moment ago. I think Nancy has at least a silent group of that are maybe not silent.
Right,
that are saying, go take Heather on, because Heather herself leveraged everybody and there's a lot of people mad about that.
Yeah, that's Stan Barnes. Also here is Julie Earthly with Mark Brody. I'm Steve Goldstein in the midst of the Friday newscap, which continues after this. It's the Friday newscap here on KJZZ in Phoenix with Mark Brody. I'm Steve Goldstein. Our guests today are Stan Barnes of Copper State Consulting and Julie Earthly of Earthly Uncuffed.
All right, guys, let's talk about going all the way back to Monday when we had the ruling in the state Supreme Court case. Feels like a long time ago at this point. The Supreme Court ruled on the Brush and Nib case, basically saying that this Phoenix company was allowed to refuse to make a certain type of invitation for same-sex weddings. Julie, a lot of conservatives have said this is a big win for religious freedom. A lot of liberals and Democrats said, well, yes, but it's also a very narrow ruling, so it doesn't really address the bigger question here. How do you think about what the Supreme Court did here?
I don't think it was a narrow ruling, to be totally honest. I mean, I know they're trying to pit it in that manner, but certainly Alliance Defending Freedom, who brought this case, they don't see it in that manner. I mean, they're going to continue to bring cases to continue to challenge this. From my perspective, this was not about freedom of speech. I mean, what speech were they really protecting? The fact that they didn't want to say Jim and Jim are getting married, that they only want to say, there wasn't a lot of speech there to protect. So I guess I find fault with the entire ruling. I think it's very troubling. I think it goes back to the time when people talked about deeply held religious beliefs against interracial marriage. I think it's very troubling. And I think it I think there's one other thing that this brings up, which is important and definitely progressives are looking at and they're very upset about, and that's the fact that Ducey's court expansion, you know, his expanding the Arizona Supreme Court really was quite beneficial, and in what a lot of progressives see as a very political, ideological tool to get some rulings on that court, including this ruling, that are very counter to at least progressive values.
Stan, do you see this as a narrow decision, a more broad-reaching decision?
I see it as a Arizona large voice in a national discussion about this issue. It's going to roll up into an even bigger national discussion. We're having our own version of it. I was saying off the air that I was just at a fabulous Italian vacation because I had a son get married there, and so it reminds me that Clint Bolick, in his writing about this case, referenced Michelangelo as part of his answer about why he came where he came, that if Michelangelo were alive, you could compel him to sell statues to whoever wanted to buy one, but you could not compel him to paint something that he deemed blasphemous. And so this is right where the narrow is. Julie says she doesn't see it as a free speech thing. The court, for its own purposes, saw it as that. And this is going to go this way and that way in different states, going to give the Supreme Court. And we're culturally going to have to get around to adapting to it, and it's a meaningful thing, really, to talk about.
Stan, how much of this is a backlash to tolerance, diversity? You used the term political correctness before. How much of that is about that in particular, where people want to claim, and certainly maybe rightfully in their hearts, that they have this feeling that they're being persecuted for their religion or whatever it may be, when in essence it can in some ways lessen the requirement to be tolerant of other people's views, or that also may be strongly held in their hearts and their souls?
If I hear you right, Steve, my response is, I think this is going to give me some hate mail. I think a lot of this is made up. I think a lot of it is much ado about—
By both sides?
By both sides. Much ado about nothing. Trying to make a point, a political point. Now, I've not been in their shoes. I've not been in the position of feeling discriminated against, et cetera. Or I've not even been on the other side of it where I'm making that decision. So maybe I don't know what I'm talking about. But as a voter, as somebody that reads what's going on, feels like he's plugged in, I just feel like it's kind of a bunch of counting angels on a pin when the real world is out there doing its thing. And we've progressed so far. Gay marriage is not even a political issue anymore. It was... In the last gubernatorial race, a non-issue, even as the court made that decision right there when Doug Ducey was running, and everybody just yawned. And I think culture is going the right way. Society is going the right way. We're more tolerant and open than ever. And so we get hung up on these little things, and I think that almost sets the whole thing back.
Julie, what about what the governor had to say about this? Again, you mentioned the court packing, quote unquote,
right,
but even in addition to what he thinks about whether the state needs some sort of anti-discrimination law.
Well, I mean, from a progressive viewpoint, I think in an anti-discrimination law on the state level would be very welcome. But I think the governor got really what he wanted in this case, and he scored some political points, to be totally honest. I mean, I agree with Stan that the culture is moving in a certain direction, and this is definitely sort of that last-ditch attempt to hold back where progress is being made. So I think, by and large, I think this was just very political. It was political on the part of Alliance Defending Freedom. This is what they want. It was political on the part of Governor Ducey, who saw this as a great win for those base voters who want him to do something about the fact that the culture is progressing and that gay marriage is legal.
Julie, do you anticipate more similar types of lawsuits, be it florists, bakers, bands, other things that may relate to weddings?
Definitely. I mean, Alliance Defending Freedom essentially said as much. And I believe that there is a case right now with a florist in, is it Washington State, that's going forward there. And I think until the Supreme Court takes this issue up, we're going to continue to see this play through the state courts. But the Supreme Court doesn't seem to be in a hurry to take this issue up, so it could be several years.
They kind of punted on that Colorado Baker case.
They definitely punted, and I think they may continue to punt for several more years.
Stan, when it comes down to the so-called culture wars, we had another interesting one this week with Speaker Bowers going after Superintendent of Public Instruction Kathy Hoffman related to sex education. What do you think? Does this sort of fall into the same category you were talking about of both sides sort of getting riled up, or is there something to this? Because it for some people, it seemed like, why are Speaker Bowers, why is Sylvia Allen, why are they stepping into this? Because for many people, it seems like they're taking the extreme on this, or maybe there is some criticism, but they're taking it almost to the point of, okay, pitchforks and run through the streets.
Yeah, this is a very interesting phenomenon for me. The context is that Speaker Bowers and Sylvia Allen, Senator Allen, are both longtime civic-oriented political people. I mean, they've been engaged in this for 30 years or so. And when they began, this kind of rhetoric about what the government's doing on sex education was really white hot as a topic. It's cooled down a great deal over the last 30 years. But when they started, that was embedded in both of them as conservative viewpointed elected officials, that this issue is an issue that they feel in their heart, and they've carried it with them. So when I think about what transpired in the last week, and I think they're kind of reverting to their original civic activity. That's how I judge them. They may not be looking at it from a 2019 perspective. They're certainly not looking at it from what is a strategic leverage political perception. They're just going on raw gut instinct about a very controversial issue that was there when they started as people in elective office. That's my answer for that.
Well, but how much of this is about the political thing again, that, okay, now we have a young woman in the superintendent's office and she is not judgmental about LGBTQ, and so are they seeing they're just digging their heels in so much now because of that background as opposed to looking at it from a more practical, pragmatic way?
The short answer is I don't know, but there is a constituency that is uncomfortable with any government activism, if you will, on the topic. And I don't know how big that constituency is. There's a lot of it in the Republican Party, but a lot of it not in the Republican Party. And to repeat myself a little bit, Sylvia Allen and Rusty Bowers both genuinely believe that the role of government in this particular topic should be very limited. And Kathy Hoffman doesn't believe that, and that's where the rub is, I think.
Well, I would agree with Stan that I think that this is a step or an instance where they're just kind of moving backwards to a different time and place. I think what's unfortunate is they may believe that very much so in their hearts, but as the Arizona Mirror pointed out earlier this week, if Sylvia Allen gets what she wants in this next legislative session, which is to ban any talk of sexual education prior to fifth grade, then some of the work that the Task Force on Preventing Child Sex Abuse is trying to do could come into jeopardy. One of the things that they want to do is to implement more teaching in elementary schools that allows students to learn about, for instance, the proper names of body parts, to understand the difference between a good and a bad touch. This is what prosecutors and others who deal with child sex abuse victims understand as very important to helping prevent or expose child sex abuse. And so Sylvia Allen may not understand that what she is doing is actually a step backwards and actually puts people in jeopardy. And I think it also speaks to this larger topic of why are we considering information, excuse me, and education to be such a bad thing? Why do we think that because we tell people about proper names of body parts and we discuss peer pressure surrounding sexuality and how to keep yourself safe and avoid STIs, why do we think that that turns people into sexual deviants? I mean, it just seems really quite ludicrous. Education is not bad. It's no different than believing that, oh, if we educate our kids about drug use, that suddenly they're going to become drug addicts. It's really just a very backwards view, and I think a misunderstanding of the importance of why we even have sexual education.
You know, I don't want someone from the government, even a teacher, talking to my pre-fifth grader about these topics. It's just where I come from. It's just in me. I'm not comfortable with that, and I don't like the potential for exploitation. There's a lot of possible bad that comes from it. I just assume handle that in my own family, and so there's nothing moral high ground, I don't think, about taking the other point of view. I can see the logic in it, the dry logic. But, I mean, after all, who's against education? But these are very sensitive topics, very important topics. And the relative age of the person involved in it is a parental responsibility and not a governmental responsibility. So there are big constituencies perhaps on both sides of that.
Very quickly, I'm sorry, we just have about a minute or so left. I'm curious if either of you think this week's comments back and forth will have any impact when the State Board of Ed takes this up, whenever they decide to take this up again.
It'll probably just prevent them from doing anything. That seems to be what happens with the State Board of Education, is anytime there's a controversy, they just punt. So I think that could be it. But just briefly to touch on Stan's point, I think one of the things that we need to understand when we're talking about age-appropriate sexual education is we're not talking about teaching the same thing to third graders as we are to 13 or 17-year-olds. It's a very different type of curriculum. And we're talking, and parents don't always have these conversations. And that's one of the things that the Task Force on Preventing Child Sexual Abuse is trying to let people understand. Sometimes it is parents, it is relatives who are the ones who are victimizing these kids. And so this is an opportunity to find those victims sooner.
Okay. That is Julie Earthly of Earthly Uncuffed and Stan Barnes of Copper State Consulting. Guys, thanks for being here.
You bet.
Thank you.
Good morning. You're listening to the show here on KJZZ 91.5. I'm Mark Brody along with Steve Goldstein. And we, of course, would like to say hello to listeners at KAWC in Yuma and Parker. Thank you for listening this morning on Colorado River Public Media. Nurses at Tucson St. Joseph's and St. Mary's Hospitals began a 24-hour strike this morning. According to the National Nurses Organizing Committee, this marks the first time registered nurses have ever taken such action in Arizona, and it comes as nurses at affiliated hospitals in Florida and California walk out as well. More than 800 nurses were expected to participate in Tucson. They're urging management to invest more in staff, improve recruitment and retention, the argument being that there's a direct correlation between staffing levels and better results for the people in nurses' care. Dominique Hamilton has been a registered nurse at St. Mary's Hospital in the Orthopedic and Neurology Unit for 3 years and says she's seen inadequate staffing affect patient outcomes in her time in the field. Our co-host Lauren Gilger spoke with her more about it.
So tell us, what has brought you and your colleagues to this point? Why are you striking?
We're striking in order to advocate for our patients. That's the number one reason. We want them to get the most optimal care that they can get. And so we're out here urging the hospital to invest in the RN staff, specifically for recruitment and retention of RN.
So give us a sense of what's led up to this for you personally and for the broader issue for nurses. What are the factors that are really contributing to this?
So I can't talk about anything specific with a specific patient, but I can talk to you about staffing, which is the number one thing for nurses. There's some pretty well-established research that says that for good patient outcomes, RN staffing levels have these sort of optimal numbers. So for on a medical surgical floor, such as mine, the optimal number for number of patients per nurse in a 12-hour shift would be 4. And right now, currently, the staffing grid allows for 6 patients per nurse. In a similar light, the progressive care unit, that optimal number is 3 patients to a nurse. And right now, currently, it is allowed for 5.
So what are you hoping will come out of this? I mean, do you and the other nurses involved have concrete requests that you're making, or are you sort of looking for a way to push for further conversation about your work conditions and staffing levels?
Well, specifically, we as the nurses union are looking for a strong contract. We unionized last year with the National Nurses United and NNOC, which is the National Nurses Organizing Committee, last October. And since the beginning of this calendar year, we've been in negotiations with our hospital and with Tenet in order to get a strong contract between the nurses and the hospital. That'll be in effect for the next 3 years. And so that contract is what will help us get those working conditions that will eventually lead to the best patient care, which is ultimately our goal.
I want to talk about the effect this is going to have on these hospitals. I've read more than 800 nurses are expected to participate in Tucson. This is a 24-hour strike. What are the hospitals going to do in that time?
Yes. So the nurses of the union gave the hospital 10 days notice, and this is the legally required advance notice that tells them that we are going to be on strike. So that is required so that the hospital can make all the appropriate arrangements to safeguard patient care.
Hmm. I want to ask you also just a personal question about why you became a nurse and what kind of frustrations you've run up against in the years that you've been doing this job that make you worry about the results and the effect it could have on your patients.
I became a nurse because I saw firsthand when I was young what they do. I had a parent who was very sick, and the nurses were there. They were there not only with the medications that were necessary and the education, but they were kind and expressed a lot of compassion and kept up that fighting spirit, which was really necessary in those dark moments. So that definitely was the number one influence of why I wanted to do this job. I wanted to be able to do that for somebody else. And on the floor that I work on and in the hospital that I work at, that spirit is definitely alive. Not only the simplicity of wanting to help people, but wanting to help people in their most vulnerable moments. Nurses are there. They're there for people, you know, from the first moment they come into this world, in the labor and delivery room, through injury, through illness, and then in their last moments as well. And we're there for not only the patients, but their patient family members. This strike, I think, is an extension of that, being there for our patients and being advocates for our patients.
That's Dominique Hamilton, a registered nurse at St. Mary's in Tucson, who will be striking for the next 24 hours or so. Dominique, thank you for your time.
Thank you so much.
And that was our co-host Lauren Gilger. We did reach out to Tenet Healthcare, with which the participating hospitals are affiliated. In an emailed statement, officials said they value the company's nursing staff and, quote, will continue to negotiate in hopes of reaching a successful resolution, end quote. The company also assured patients they'll be cared for by qualified nurses and caregivers through any strike.
There is a significant lack of affordable housing in the Valley, but a new initiative is trying to tackle the problem one donation at a time. Starting about a month ago, homebuyers have had the option of donating $25 when they close on their houses. That money goes to the Arizona Housing Fund, which is managed by the Arizona Community Foundation. We should also note that the Arizona Community Foundation is a financial supporter of KJZZ. The donated money will be used to provide more affordable housing here. Howard Epstein founded the Arizona Housing Fund. He's worked at Bank of America for 30 years, and he joins me. And Howard, what was the thinking behind this effort?
So I have been in the battling the homeless problem in this community for about 25 years, serving on various boards. What we found is that whenever we were able to bring new housing units online, permanent supportive housing units online, it opened up the rest of the system, meaning that people who were in temporary shelters could now move into permanent housing, and people who were on the streets could then move into emergency shelters. So what we decided to do was come up with a way to have a dedicated and sustainable revenue source to help fund nonprofits who do permanent support of low-income and working poor housing.
Why, in your mind, is this the best way to approach it as opposed to going after grants or federal money or maybe try to get a fee attached to something like this? This is a voluntary donation.
It is. The original thought was it would be great if our state legislature would enact a law that said every time somebody buys or sells a home at a title company, they'd have to give $25 to this kind of effort. But I quickly learned that getting something like that done would be really difficult. So we tacked to the private sector solution, and we have found amazing support for that. And so starting with the home builder community, the multi-housing community, realtors, we're finding that all of these groups, particularly those that are in the residential housing industry, want to be part of the solution, and this is a great way to do it.
Is there something special about the number that you landed on, $25?
It's very non-offensive. Trying to figure out a way that people cannot say no. So if you're buying a $100,000, $200,000, $500,000 house, maybe the cheapest line item on your settlement sheet when you close escrow, it would be a $25 donation to the housing fund.
Do you have goals in mind of how much money you'd like to raise and how much realistically you think you can raise in a given year?
Yeah, we have very lofty goals, mainly just based on all the support we're getting as we go out and talk to people in the community. It's not unthinkable, given all these numbers, that the fund couldn't raise $100 million over the next 15 or 20 years. So very, very big, bold goals.
So we have talked on the show before about how there is a lot of apartment building happening in the Valley, but much of it is on the high end, sort of the luxury apartments, clearly not what we're talking about here. What are the challenges to getting affordable housing, especially rental housing, built in this community?
It's very difficult because it doesn't really make economic sense for multi-housing developers to do this kind of thing. So the agencies, the nonprofits who do this, it's a dedicated approach to doing this. And, you know, for example, Arizona Housing Inc., which operates 700 units, you know, a typical rent may be $400 or $500. So that's something that a lot of people can live with, and versus market rate apartments, which can be well into the $1,500 or more.
So the money that you raise from these donations, is this being used to actually build the units? What is the money being used
for?
Yeah,
so the fund will be a conduit to get dollars to the nonprofits who have a track record of building and operating these projects. And so we're advocates for those nonprofits. Money comes into the fund. We have an advisory committee that will help allocate and distribute the dollars, and it would go to like a UMOM, Save the Family, Catholic Charities, the groups that strictly do this. So the fund itself isn't going to develop units. It's going to go to the nonprofits who are able to bring new inventory to our market.
Is this kind of thing being done in other places?
No, this is new, and this is why it's getting a lot of attention. As far as we can tell and have been told, it's not happening in any other state. So I think there's a lot of people right now watching us, and if this works here, which we think it will, there's no reason to think that it couldn't be rolled out into other communities and other states.
Understanding that different projects have different costs, do you have a ballpark of roughly how much it costs to get one of these projects going and get it up and having people live there?
Yeah, it's very expensive. So to build, say, an 80-unit project, it can be, you know, $100,000 to $125,000 a unit. So, you know, an 80-unit project could be upwards to $10 million. So it takes a lot of money to get these kinds of deals done.
How big of a dent do you think this ideally could put into the problem in the Valley of affordable housing?
I think it could put a big dent in it. You know, we're not going to end homelessness because that's just unrealistic. And not everybody who lives on the streets wants to get to housing, but we're really looking to help the people who do want housing. And that's a formidable population. It's a supply and demand issue. The demand is growing. The supply is not keeping up with it. And so you could literally build thousands of units over the next couple of years and still not meet the demand.
Well, Howard, thanks a lot for coming in.
Thank you.
Howard Epstein is founder of the Arizona Housing Fund.
Well, that deserves a wow. Mark, you know, you've had a lot of ideas over the years because I've known you forever.
Yeah, many,
that
many
you
ideas.
Think are funny, but you probably wouldn't carry out.
Yeah, there was that time I pitched doing an entire show dedicated to Seinfeld that
went nowhere
fast. Well,
there's still hope for that.
But I don't think so.
This next story is about one of those wouldn't it be funny ideas that's actually taken off. Here's Stephanie Carrico, owner of the Trunk Space in downtown Phoenix.
So probably 10 years ago now, I was goofing with some friends and I was like, man, there's a race, the Indy 500, and Indy is a style of music. It'd be funny to do an Indy 500 where there's 500 songs.
And that is what started the Indy 500. That's Indy with an I-E. It's a marathon of a music festival in its sixth year, which starts today.
There are going to be 100 bands playing 500 songs as quickly as they can. Here's Carrico again.
We call it a race, and we try to beat last year's time and how fast we can get through 500 songs. And everybody has to work together. We have two stages, so music doesn't stop. So you have to get in, you got to get set up, you got to play your songs quickly, and you have to depend on each other, I think, in a way that's different than a normal show.
Now, for Carrico, it's a lot of work every year, some of which she's managed to pass off to volunteers this time around. But she says it's all worth it when she gets to watch this kind of community it creates.
People have met good friends there because you're hanging out for, you know, 36 hours sometimes. People have seen bands they wouldn't normally see and become friends with people that they wouldn't normally meet and created new projects. So I definitely think it can build that.
So if you want to go check it out this weekend, get ready.
It's $10 for a wristband. Once you've got a wristband, you can leave and come back. So if you want to go sleep for a while, you can. People sometimes have brought sleeping bags and slept in the courtyard on the grass.
And whether you stay and sleep on the grass or just come for a few songs, Carrico says she hopes it offers a uniquely Phoenix experience.
I hope that people get to see some music, some performers they've never seen. I hope they get a better appreciation for the community we have here. I think the music community in Phoenix is really cool. It's big. It's crazy that we can pretty easily book 100 bands.
And Carrico says her favorite time of the festival is early in the morning.
Because you have a bunch of people that have been up all night and they're kind of goofy, but then they're also bonded in this way. And then seeing music as the sun comes up is such a cool thing that we don't normally get to see.
The Indy 500 starts this afternoon at Trunk Space and ends Sunday morning at 2 a.m.
That's the show for today. This has been a KJZZ original production from Phoenix. You can find photos, audio segments, and more information about the program at theshow.kjzz.org. I'm Mark Brody. Thanks for listening to the show podcast.